GreenSense is brought to you by JLT Specialty USA, the world's largest energy insurance broker, serving the entire energy continuum. Visit JLTUS.com.
Welcome to GreenSense, a weekly look at the people, policies, and innovations that are changing our world. Here's Robert Colangelo.
That's me, scientist, author, and environmental entrepreneur, and I get to do all the easy work.
I'm behind the scenes, working the phones, doing the planning, Bob Kessler, executive producer.
And Bob and I, we explore environmental issues and innovations, and we get to meet the passionate people that are changing the world.
Passionate, yes, but they also must make common and economic sense. That is how they get here on GreenSense.
And I query them to make sure that their ideas also make environmental sense and there's a benefit for the planet.
You know, this is the weekend for the March for Science, but is it effective? We got a guy who's a scientist who's done a lot of research on the climate, but he doesn't think the march is really the way to get the message out.
When you listen to GreenSense, every day is Earth Day, and all that information's coming up on this week's edition. While the U.S. continues to debate if climate change exists, sea levels are rising with serious impact to coastal and island communities. Hugh Seeley is a professor in the Department of Public Health and Preventive Medicine at St. George's University in Grenada. He was also the lead negotiator for small island states at the COP22 summit in Morocco and joins us now on GreenSense.
Hi.
Well, you wrote an op-ed piece for US Today where you tell us rising sea levels fueled by climate change threaten the very existence of my country, the Caribbean nation of Grenada. What kind of threats are you dealing with there right now?
Well, Robert, right now the sea levels are rising at around 3 millimeters per year. And that rate of sea level rise is accelerating. So we're locked in now to at least 1 meter of sea level rise, we think, by the end of the century, and it could be close to 2 meters of sea level rise. And when I look around, you know, I'm at the campus now at St. George's University, and I look outside my window, and I project what 2 meters sea level rise means. That means that we're going to lose the majority of our tourism infrastructure, or seaports, or airports. It's going to be very, very difficult to recover from that type of catastrophic loss of infrastructure. And people are going to have to move inland or move off the country entirely.
So 3 millimeters looks like a small amount on a yearly basis. Do you see fluctuations, or is that a continual rise every year? Do some years, does it drop?
Well, that's year on year that we were seeing about 3.2 millimeters of sea level rise. And as I said, that rate is accelerating. So the rate is getting faster and faster. And that does not include any loss of the Greenland ice sheet or the West Antarctica ice sheets. If you factor that in, then sea level rise will be even more significant. But then sea level rise is only one thing. On top of that, you're going to get ocean acidification, which in simple terms, the oceans are going to get more acidic. And that's really, really bad news for anything that has calcium carbonate in it. So any coral reefs will be damaged. And then you're going to have storm surges as well from extreme weather events. So you're going to have sea level rise on top of that, storm surges on top of that, you're going to lose your coral reefs, which act as a barrier to wave action. So it's not good news for any coastal states.
No, you're not painting a very pretty picture for island paradises. This is very threatening. And what's really disconcerting here is that we have a current administration that doesn't even recognize climate change, yet you're visibly and undeniably seeing consequences from the climate change. How do the people of your country view our current presidential administration's position when it seems to just brush off climate change as not really a threat?
Well, as a negotiator on climate change for all the small islands, and that's 39 of us, I am acutely sensitive to the United States' position. We would not have gotten the Paris Agreement in December of 2015 unless the United States and China had come to an agreement prior to Paris. And I find it quite interesting that when we're speaking, the presidents of the U.S. and China are meeting, and that to me is going to be quite interesting. What are they going to talk about? I hope they talk about climate change, because it's absolutely imperative that the two largest economies in the world, the ones that produce the most greenhouse gas emissions, I'm speaking of China and the USA, continue to decarbonize their economies as quickly as possible. So we're waiting to see what the United States' position is going to be at the upcoming negotiations in May in Bonn.
My guest is UC Lee, professor in the Department of Public Health and Preventative Medicine at St. George's University in Grenada, and we're talking about how climate change is impacting island nations. Our current U.S. Secretary of State endorsed the Paris Agreement when he was head of Exxon. He also supported a carbon tax, but as Secretary of State, he's been somewhat mysterious and seldom taking questions from the press and not making a lot of public statements. Are you still feeling like he could be effective when it comes to be an advocate for climate change?
Not sure. Not sure where the U.S. is going. I was heartened, or we were heartened, by the new CEO of Exxon restating that from a corporate standpoint, from a business standpoint, that they're anxious to see a significant price put on carbon. I thought that was significant. So if the administration continues to listen to business, it will recognize that having strong regulations and having a substantial price on carbon is actually what the industry is asking for.
A number of the commitments made by many nations to reduce emissions just don't seem to be enough, according to the UN. Are world leaders that you've encountered aware of this, and do they have any desire to change?
You could say that the Paris Agreement, if I'm in an optimistic mood, I would say that Paris was historic and Paris was a great success. If I'm in a pessimistic mood, I say, well, the contributions that countries have made in the Paris Agreement are not enough to keep global warming less than 2 degrees. Matter of fact, we're still on a path for 3 degrees or more of warming. And that would be absolutely catastrophic for small islands. We have to limit warming to less than 1.5 degrees Celsius. And we're already at warming of 1 degree Celsius. So we have very little carbon budget left. So you're absolutely right that the contributions, you can't call them commitments because they aren't legally binding, but the contributions, these nationally determined contributions that countries are making, are not yet sufficient, and that we have to urgently ramp up our mitigation efforts.
Well, you have a very interesting perspective. You're in two worlds. You're seeing firsthand the impacts and the effects of climate change, and then you're also involved with the bureaucracy of nations trying to solve global problems in a united fashion. You know, to many of us, just commoners who don't go to these big international events, these look like a lot of talk. How do you feel when you actually see where you live, your islands changing, and yet you go to these events where there's a lot of talk and little action?
I find it frustrating, quite frankly, and I wish I could shake my fellow negotiating partners, the Australians, the Japanese, the Chinese, the Brazilians, the Americans, and tell them, hey, look, small islands, we're the canaries in the coal mine. We're the conscience of this convention. if we go down, the rest of you will follow. And we're very, very close to not being in existence anymore in the next 100 years. So come on, guys, wake up. This is an existential threat. This is the greatest public health threat faced by mankind. Then I recognize that nothing happens in a day. It's really, really hard to get 190-something countries to agree on something. And the way that we do things in the United Nations, it has to be consensus. So one country can block anything. I find it absolutely amazing that we've gotten this far. But now we have to recognize that we're all in the same boat, and we've got to start to row together and row a bit more quickly than we've been doing in the past.
Well, Gandhi said, when the people lead, the leaders will follow. Maybe it's time for the people to do something. And if you had a chance to talk to the people of the world, what would you tell them to do that can help impact your island nation in a positive way when it comes to sea level rise?
That's a good question. And I've found that we've got to personalize climate change. We've got to change it from something abstract in the future, and what happens to people in distant islands or distant shores, to something that's happening to us. And climate change is going to affect the people in Chicago as well. It's already impacting upon your lifestyles as well. So I would say to people, continue to advocate, make it a big political issue. Make sure that you elect politicians that believe in climate change, that believe in the science, and have a sense of urgency to address it. I think there's one big myth that's out there, and that is that we have to sacrifice a whole heap to change our lifestyles and decarbonize our economies. That's absolutely not true. We have the technology now, we have the renewable energy now, that we can maintain our lifestyles and yet still save the planet.
Many of us are disenfranchised with politicians solving problems. What can we do as individuals?
We can reduce our own carbon footprints. Yes, I think that the technology is there for us now with electric vehicles, with solar panels and wind, that we can do it at an individual level, and then we can elect politicians that would do it at the regional, the state, and at the federal level.
Well, we really appreciate you being on Green Sense. We appreciate you having your toes in both waters, the bureaucratic one and the island one. So continue to do your good work. And if there's any updates, feel free to contact us and we'll have you back on the show.
Well, thank you for having me on the show.
That's Hugh Seeley with the Department of Public Health and Preventative Medicine at St. George's University in Grenada, joining us on Green Sense to talk about climate change policy around the globe. I'm Robert Calandro. Remember to subscribe to the Green Sense Radio podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, and Google Play when you visit greensensefarms.com.
Green Sense is sponsored by JLT Specialty USA, experienced professionals ensuring energy, technology, and aerospace, serving complex risk with creative solutions. Visit usa.jlt.com.
This weekend, on the National Mall in Washington, D.C., and in more than 400 locations around the world, scientists and supporters of science have been marching. But at least one scientist who's done extensive research on climate change thinks that the march is a bad idea. We're joined by Robert S. Young, professor of coastal geology at Western Carolina University. Rob, welcome to Green Sense.
Glad to be with you.
Well, for the record, you're not a climate change denier, are you?
No, far from it.
Well, as the March for Science organizers put it, that they're there to take a public stand against budget cuts, censorship of researchers, disappearing data sets, and threats to dismantle government agencies, which could damage our health, food, air, water, climate, and put jobs at risk. And you wrote in the New York Times op-ed piece that ran earlier this year, the March for Science is a terrible idea. What's your thinking on that?
Well, all of those things are important things to stand up for. I guess I'm just not convinced strategically that a march is going to make any difference, and that a march is going to reach any of the decision makers that might be able to impact the issues that the organizers have raised. And, you know, I do have some concerns that the optics of the march joined with the Earth Day celebration is going to play into a conservative narrative that will allow the conservative blogosphere and the skeptics to continue to just try to paint scientists as a political interest group rather than as people concerned about evidence-based decision making.
What is your suggestion on how to best reach decision makers?
Well, you know, these days that's complicated, right? I mean, we have some decision makers who've already made all the decisions they're going to make in a lifetime, and I'm not sure they're ready to change their minds. I think we need to be focusing our efforts on the local level and reaching out to citizens and voters rather than trying to change the minds of, you know, the Freedom Caucus, for example, or even President Trump. You know, I'm not sure how President Trump makes decisions. But I do think that we need a broader effort within the scientific community to reach into local decision-making, planning boards, town boards, school boards, things like that, and that scientists need to do a better job of reaching out into rural and working-class America and reminding people why science matters.
Marches and public displays have been the way to raise awareness about issues. Why do you see that ineffective these days?
Well, you know, in the 1960s, when the civil rights activists were marching for equal rights for everybody, you know, we all pretty much got our news from the same news sources. Today, our nation is not just divided politically, but we live in divided media environments. So the idea that the people that we're interested in reaching are going to read a lot of press about the march, you know, I'm not sure that's going to be true. You know, how is Fox News going to cover this march? Are they going to cover it in a flattering way? Are they going to cover it in detail? Are they going to talk about how many people were there and what the real issues are? So, you know, I think the march will definitely reach people who we've already convinced. But a lot of the people that we need to be talking to don't get their news from CNN and the New York Times and National Public Radio and the same media outlets that, you know, the converted do. And so, you know, that makes things a little bit different these days. You can't just assume that if you have a march and a lot of people show up that it's going to reach or educate everybody that you want to reach and educate.
You're listening to Green Sense. My guest is Rob Young, professor of coastal geology at Western Carolina University. And we're talking about his op-ed piece that appeared in the New York Times, stating why the March for Science may not be an effective way to reach legislators. Well, in your op-ed piece, you also claim that it'll make your job as a coastal geologist more difficult. Why and how?
Well, I am interested in reaching out to people in rural America who have sort of lost touch with scientists and maybe even with the professional class in general in the U.S., and, you know, I'm interested in showing these people that scientists really are simply about evidence-based decision-making, about facts and respect for facts, and hoping that policymakers will respect the evidence when they're making decisions. And if, if the march is portrayed in a way by certain news outlets in the conservative blogosphere as, playing into this narrative where scientists are simply liberal environmentalists, and you know that the memes that they're going to capture from this march are going to be the most offensive signs that someone's holding. The organizers will not be able to control the message. Well, then, that makes my job trying to offer a hand to these rural communities, it makes my job more difficult because, scientists will be portrayed as liberal activists. And, conservatives tend not to have marches. So just the idea of the march itself, brings to mind a certain wing of political activism.
Well, humor is a good way to get a message across. And in 2010, you co-authored a report for North Carolina's Coastal Resource Commission about the rise in sea levels. But the response from the legislator was absurd enough that Stephen Colbert joked about it on his show. Tell us the full story and what you learned from it.
Well, the full story would be a very long story.
Give us the cliff notes.
I serve on the science panel that advises North Carolina's Coastal Resources Commission, which is our coastal regulatory body. And we were asked to write a report on sea level rise and, what the scientific consensus is on the amount of sea level rise we could experience in North Carolina by the end of the century. And when the report was delivered, there were certain interests within the state, both in, the private sector and within elected officials that looked at the number and said, yikes, we don't like that. And so there was this whole kerfuffle that ensued. And the legislature clearly overreacted in a ridiculous fashion by, essentially saying that the state's not allowed to think about the possibility of an acceleration in sea level rise. And, I think that they regret that overreaction because they were largely ridiculed nationally. And they did really back off on that to some degree. But I did learn some important lessons from that. And, one lesson that I learned is that the folks in these coastal communities that were all of a sudden hit with this sea level rise prediction, they had never really met any of the scientists on the science panel for the Coastal Resources Commission. So, it wasn't the message that we delivered in person. It was easy for the naysayers to demonize us when none of the people in eastern North Carolina were familiar with us. They couldn't put a face on the report. There wasn't, we weren't people that they knew and trusted. And in addition to that, a 100-year out sea level rise projection, in retrospect, how useful is that if you're a planner in a local community? I mean, what planning office has a 100-year planning horizon? Well, nobody does. We probably should have emphasized the short-term management needs rather than sort of just dropping this bomb of what's going to happen 100 years from now.
Well, in your New York Times op-ed piece, you wrote something I really liked, is that we need storytellers, not marchers. Explain what you meant by that.
At the end of the day, I firmly believe that the way we're going to convince the rest of America that science is important, that scientists are just regular folks like them, and that things like climate change are worth thinking about is through personal interaction and making real connections with people. So, and that means two things. That means that we need scientists that are willing to do AM radio and walk into local Rotary, Ruritan, and Kiwanis and meet people and put a face on science. And it also means that we need to re-message the conversation when we're talking about something like climate change. I have family in eastern North Carolina, and I have family that farm. And you can't walk in there and start talking about climate change to them by talking about polar bears. When you're in a community that's struggling with job loss and the decline of your downtown and opioid addiction, caring about polar bears is a luxury. so scientists need to think about the message that we're delivering, because all politics is local. And if you want people to be concerned about something, you have to do a better job of explaining why it really matters to them at home.
Well, Rob, that was the reason we put Green Sense together. We felt that there was all this information on sustainability, but it was lofty, and you need to bring it down to an easy-to-understand level. So I think scientists have some work to do on how they can communicate their message and how they present it. And I think you're on the right track here, and we really appreciate you sharing your thoughts here on Green Sense.
My pleasure.
That's Robert Young, professor of coastal geology at Western Carolina University, talking about the March for Science. We've included a link to his New York Times op-ed in this week's show notes. Subscribe to the Green Sense Radio podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, and Google Play when you visit greensensefarms.com. Thanks for listening to this week's edition of Green Sense, where every day is Earth Day. Send any comments or suggestions or ideas to me at robert@greensenseshow.com. We'll be back next week with...
We have one of the top lawyers when it comes to water rights. Actually, I think he's the top lawyer. He just won the Stockholm Water Prize, so he's been honored internationally. And we'll get into water rights and how people can actually fight or get along when it comes to access to clean water.
Subscribe to the Green Sense Radio podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, and Google Play by visiting greensensefarms.com and view the list of radio stations that air our show. Our goal is to be an honest broker of sustainable information so that you can make informed decisions. Stay fresh, keep innovating, because when you're green, you grow.
Green Sense is recorded in the Duneland ecosystem on the eastern shores of Lake Michigan at Green Sense Farms, the largest indoor commercial vertical farm in the world. We walk the walk and talk the talk, growing leafy green vegetables 24/7, free of pesticides, herbicides, with non-GMO seeds, conserving resources, and reducing waste. Watch us grow. The program is copyright Green Sense Farms, all rights reserved.
Green Sense is brought to you by JLT Specialty USA, the world's largest energy insurance broker, serving the entire energy continuum. Visit jltus.com.